Radio. I'm Alex Heiko.
And I'm Jacob Friedenberg. This week from our Global Media Newsroom, we have news
from China.
Genshin Impact is a role-playing game from China that is breaking records. Millions of people are playing it. Why is this game so popular, and what makes it so special?
From Indonesia.
The streaming competition is heating up in Indonesia. Can an Indonesian streaming giant, ironically called Video, compete with the global giants at Netflix? How many people are watching streaming video on demand in Indonesia?
From Iran.
Why are so many directors and film personnel threatened with arrest in Iran? Is the film industry a problem for the government? Did this harassment begin with a recent wave of protests? Or has there always been this kind of tension between the Khamenei regime and the filmmakers that are in Iran?
From Pakistan.
How tough are the cyber laws in Pakistan? What can you post on social media? What will get you arrested? Is the government protecting the public or censoring dissent?
From North Korea.
Is there any freedom of expression in North Korea? Can these citizens access the same internet we do? How does the government of North Korea keep this nation isolated? And can Kim Jong-un control the internet?
All this and more coming up on OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio, streaming live from the State University of New York, College at Old Westbury.
My co-host, Alex Heigto, is one on the gaming beat this week for New Media Beat. One of the most popular games right now is from China. It is called Genshin Impact. While the game is a product of a Chinese company, it looks a bit Japanese. Why, Alex, the gaming news site Polygon calls Genshin an open-world exploration game. Why is Genshin Impact an open-world exploration game, and just how popular is this game with players?
The game is very popular with its players for two reasons. One reason is that it's free to play from the App Store or wherever you download it from. So it's free, and then so people can do anything. And also the second reason is they have an in-game system of, like, a gambling feature that allows players to buy, like, in-item stuff so you can upgrade your player or something. And the reason for the open-world exploration is it's based on, there's Chinese landmarks in the game, so you can go around and, like, role-play as Chinese, like, stuff, but the characteristics of the game is Japanese. There's, like, Japanese figures in the game and other stuff.
So, as you just mentioned, there's Chinese landmarks in this game. However, there are some that are saying that this game is more Japanese than Chinese. Why is this game considered a Chinese game?
It's considered Chinese because it was developed by a company called MiHoYo, and the game came out in 2020, and they produced it in China. So there was no reasoning on why they went to Japan. If I had to take a guess on why, it's just to get more other people to play it, not just people based in China.
What is this game about?
As I mentioned before, it's an action role-playing game, so you can basically create a character, go around the city that's based on China, and you can go around, interact with other people, have a job or something, and yeah, like I said, you can buy in-game stuff to upgrade your character and stuff.
And remind me, how is Japan involved with this game?
Japan is involved with the game as most of the cosmetics in the game are Japanese culture-based. There's giant robots in the game, people with huge eyes, crazy hairstyles, and other things.
And lastly, is this game popular in Japan?
The statistics show that it's more popular in China, but there is a fair share of Japanese people that play the game. People who play the game in Japan look at it as a knockoff to some other fantasy game franchises. And there's a Japanese YouTuber who plays the game, and he said for Japanese players, there's negative aspects. The negative aspects have been far outweighed by the positive portrayals of Japanese video game players. For New Media Beat, I'm Alex Heiko. Back to you, Jacob.
Thanks, Alex. The global streaming wars are heating up again. There is an intense competition for viewers around the world. OTT, or over-the-top, internet video services are competing with broadcast, satellite, and all forms of online entertainment. SVOD, or streaming video on demand, services are growing. Indonesia is one of these massive markets. Are Indonesians watching streaming video on foreign OTT platforms? Or could an Indonesian streaming service compete with global giants like YouTube and Netflix? Tanya Fizamay is ready to tell us about an Indonesian streaming service ironically called Video. Video is spelled V-I-D-I-O. This Indonesian streaming service may be able to challenge the global competition. Tanya, just how big is the market in Indonesia, and How many users are there in Indonesia in 2022?
In 2020, there was approximately 191 million people who had access to the internet. Last reported in 2021, Indonesia is the ninth largest market for e-commerce with a revenue of $43.4 billion.
So this streaming service, Vidio, spelled V-I-D-I-O. What is Vidio?
Vidio is an Indonesia-based streaming service servicing demand videos, also including exclusive sports and entertainment content. It was established on October 15, 2014, and it has an average of 61 million monthly active users.
So this streaming giant probably popped up because of a hole in the market. Why didn't Netflix, or why hasn't Netflix, invested more time in Indonesia's local film industry?
Netflix thought it would be too time-consuming and also expensive with no guarantee that they will make the money back. I think their audience is still growing, so I don't think there's really much of a demand from Netflix to start making content catering to them.
What is Indonesia's streaming service Vidio doing in terms of gaining more of an audience?
I know the national film market in Indonesia provides more screening for Indonesia as their market increases. The government is also ready to sponsor national film actors to work with international film actors in producing quality films that will attract more audience. The government also wants to open a negative investment list, which expands the opportunity for investors to invest in the field.
Well, that's definitely a positive for those in Indonesia, giving these actors and directors and various film personnel these opportunities. But what else have turned potential Indonesian customers away from subscribing to Netflix?
In 2016, Telkom Group, it's an Indonesia's largest telecommunication service provider. They banned Netflix due to them believing Netflix had relations to carrying pornography and supporting terrorism.
No problem. And lastly, this may be getting a little bit in the weeds, but what is the cost difference of the basic plan between the U.S. and Indonesia?
In the U.S., the basic plan is only about $6.99 a month, whereas for Indonesia, it had cut down to 109 rupees, which is about 260 per month, from 499 rupees, which is 750 per month. From New Media V, I'm Tanya Fiesman. Back to you, Jacob.
Thank you, Tanya. The protests are continuing in Iran, but so are the arrests. Some important people in the Iranian film industry are getting into trouble by supporting these protests. How far will the Iranian government go to stop the dissent?
Let's talk about Iran. The continuing protests have led to more arrests and repression. My co-host, Jacob Friedenberg, has been following the news from Iran. Jacob, the film industry in Iran is an important part of Iranian culture. There are great filmmakers in Iran, and their films have won prizes in international competitions. Why are filmmakers important in Iran, and what part have they played in the recent protests?
So, thank you for having me on, Alex. The Iran film industry has a lot of prominent directors who have made films that are just as popular as some of our most recent Hollywood movies, and they have really led to a rise in local film, more or less. There are a lot of Iranian films over the last number of years that have started to gain mainstream traction outside of Iran, so that's the main reason why it's important.
Okay, who is Jafar Panahi?
Jafar Panahi is one of these prominent directors that these future Iranian filmmakers are looking to as a role model. He's considered to be one of Iran's most influential filmmakers. He's known for films such as Taxi, which won a couple of awards, Hit the Road, and This Is Not a Film. Those are just a few of his major films. But the main thing he's known for is protesting the Iranian government, and this goes back as far as 2010 with his protest towards the Iranian regime.
Why was Panahi arrested?
So, because he had protested the Iranian government back in 2010, he had been arrested along with 15 other individuals. But since then, he had been on conditional release, but he was recently reapprehended by the morality police in Iran because he had been trying to find out information about another director who he was colleagues with by the name of Mohammad Rasulov. He's, again, arrested for being a known dissident of the Iranian government. And yeah, we're waiting to see what is going to happen to him. But as of right now, he's currently serving out the 6 years he was convicted of in 2010, but has been on conditional release since.
All right, and since Panahi has been arrested, what has the response been like in Iran?
Protests have continued to erupt. They've already been going large because of the death of Mahsa Amini, a reporter who was murdered while in police custody. But the protests in Iran have only seemed to grow in spite of him and multiple other filmmakers being arrested. This really appears to the Iranian people as a sort of suppression on freedom of expression and freedom of speech. And that is the main reason why these individuals have started to protest in such large fashion.
Has there been any other response to Panahi's arrest?
Yes, the country of France has actually urged Iran to release Panahi. That's actually why he was apprehended while heading to France for an awards show when his visa was suspended. And actually, also his son has been urging his release and discussed how people have been rebelling against the Iranian government.
Is being a media figure in Iran dangerous? If so, why?
Unfortunately, it's becoming very, very dangerous. Three directors have been arrested in the last couple of weeks, including Jafar Panahi, plus the arrest of actress Nazanin Bahrami in July over this year over the denouncement of sexual abuse in the Iran film industry has also been apprehended. That's a popular Iranian actress, for those who don't know. Plus, here in America, we had the attack of prominent author Salman Rushdie, who was known for his book The Satanic Verses. The person who attacked him at his show had praise towards former Iranian regimes, which people look at and are not quite fond of. So unfortunately, we've seen a rise in dissent. We've seen a rise in violence against those who dissent against the Iranian government. And while Iran has denied involvement in the last of those, the attack of Salman Rushdie, they say that his attack was self-inflicted and that he got himself into that situation. They actually put hate out on him in 1989. But regardless, it's a disturbing trend to see artists of all kinds, regardless of whether they're authors or filmmakers or actresses, going through these kind of attacks. And the Iranian government has shown tons of willingness to do any and all things in order to silence their opposition. From New Media Beat, I'm Jacob Friedenberg. Back to you, Alex.
Thanks, Jacob. Let's move to South Asia for a report about media in Pakistan. Pakistan is a democracy, but it has an authoritarian government that has a lot of rules about the internet. Just how strict are the rules about the internet and social media in Pakistan? Why are the rules so strict? Jessica Farrell is here to explain what you can and can't post on social media in Pakistan. Jessica, tell us about these cyber laws. Is the internet an important part of politics in Pakistan?
So if you were to ask the government in Pakistan, they would say they are trying to protect their people from fake news being posted. But if you were to ask people that use social media in Pakistan, they would say that they feel as if their freedom of speech is being taken away from them.
What are the laws in Pakistan on social media?
So these laws require social media platforms with over 500,000 users to hand over personal data. The data has to be clear and readable format for the federal investigation, and they have to do so whenever they are asked. Also, anything that is considered to be fake news has to be taken down, but people have been having their posts taken down if it goes against anything the government says.
Is there a punishment for going against these laws? If so, what?
Yes, there is punishment. If people post fake news or anything negative about the government, they could face up to 5 years of jail time without any bail.
Why did the Prime Minister Imran Khan approve these laws?
So the then Prime Minister approved these laws because he felt as if there was too much fake news being posted, which is a completely understandable thing because fake news could cause it to be very misleading for people. But jail time is an extreme. There could be less punishment, such as social media platforms being taken down from people or people being banned from being able to post instead of having to go to jail.
Has there been anyone who faced these punishments?
Yes, there were four men that were arrested for what they posted on Facebook. These men did not know each other until they were all in the courtroom together, all being charged with blasphemy. For New Media Beat, I'm Jessica Farrow. Back to you, Alex.
Thank you, Jessica.
Welcome back to Old Westbury Web Radio. What is it like to live in North Korea? Can you have a cell phone? Can you access the internet? What's on TV, if they even have TV? Is there any free or independent media in North Korea? What do North Koreans know about the world? How could they find out what is happening in other countries? Can the dictator and tyrant, Kim Jong-un, keep foreign information out of North Korea? Luca John-Elise has been studying the media landscape in North Korea. Luca, what do we need to know about the government and political system of North Korea to understand North Korean media?
Well, what do we really need to know is how their government functions. We got to start with that. They're a communist regime, and they're so restricted from the outside world that not much news goes into the country and even goes out because they don't want anyone knowing what's going on within their own country. And that just gives them, like, a better grip of controlling their own people. And we've heard a reference called the Iron Dome that was used during the Soviet Union. So they're kind of using the same concept of just really, like, locking it down and nothing goes in and out of the country.
So just to be clear, like you said, no information goes in and out unless Kim Jong-un
specifies it. Yeah, unless he approves it or he's, like, fine with it.
So, on that same topic, how is foreign media seeping into the borders of North Korea, then, a threat that is going to attack Kim Jong-un's power, but also threaten the Iron Dome that you said he's so strategically built?
It's a big threat because the people are so used to just hearing one form of information, you know, that their government's the best. And once you start hearing other ideologies coming in and your people are hearing other ideologies, they're going to start questioning your power, how you run the government. So that can turn a tide into really the people not even believing in their own government and trying to make a change. So that's a huge threat to Kim Jong-un, and especially to the Communist Party, because we've seen it with China and the Soviet Union, to how much control they really want over their people, and really of them having no say at all that what can be done.
So obviously dissent in North Korea is a big no-no.
No.
What are some of the consequences that people might be facing if they're caught with or bringing any form of outside social media or media in general that is contradictory to the party in power? What are the consequences that they could face?
Well, so it really varies. Let's say you're a parent and your child gets caught with any, you know, any, like, speaking styles from South Korea, any social media seeping in, the parent can get fined. It's more harsher, the consequences on the person, whoever gets caught. For example, some people can face up to, like, 15 years in jail. But it really varies because if you're caught with anything from Japan or especially the United States, you can be even charged with a death penalty with a firing squad. So North Korea really says a big no-no from anything coming in from the United States and Japan. Because, I mean, they've been dealing with it for multiple years from South Korea because they're neighboring countries. But a really big threat is any information from Japan or the United States.
So the consequences are serious. What does the future of North Korea look like in terms of its social media restrictions?
Well, I think it's going to get harsher and harsher as time goes by because with the development of the technology and social media, we saw the punishments getting more harsher and harsher throughout time. So I think for the nearest future, there's not really much anything that people can do in North Korea till Kim Jong-un is in power, and especially the Communist Party, because they're going to try to do their best possibility to keep everything under control. From New Media Beat, I'm Luca Gianolizzi. Back to you, Jacob.
Thank you, Luca. That's all we have for this week on New Media Beat.
Thanks for listening to New Media Beat. Thanks to our producer, Michael Green, and to our wonderful engineer, Tanya Fizeme. Many thanks to my co-host, Jacob Friedenberg.
Thanks, Alex. Today we heard reports from Jessica Farrell, Tanya Fizeme, Jacob Friedenberg, myself, Alex Heiko, and Luca John-Elise.
New Media Beat is brought to you by OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio, and the Media and Communications Department here at the State University of New York College at Old Westbury.
For more media news and resources, check out our latest posts at newmediabeat.org, where you can listen to all of our webcasts and even subscribe to our podcast feed.
Follow us on Twitter at OWWRGMN. Use our Twitter feed to keep up with the latest news for aspiring journalists and media professionals. That's at OWWRGMN.
Stay tuned for more great programming coming up next on OWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio.